From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Another blockbuster. You are a god.
Today, Michael Keaton talks about his Oscar-nominated performance in Birdman. He plays a Hollywood actor once famous for his role as the superhero Birdman, attempting to reinvent himself by writing, directing, and starring in a Broadway play. Throughout the film, Keaton's character is taunted by his Birdman alter ego, and suffers one indignity after another. In one scene, he locks himself out of the theater in his briefs.
They're pathetic enough, but what really is the beautiful finishing touch is the black socks.
Not coincidentally, Keaton, like his character, starred in a superhero franchise, Batman.
I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
How did we end up here? In this dump? You were a movie star, remember?
My guest, Michael Keaton, is nominated for an Oscar for his starring performance in the film Birdman, which is nominated for 8 other Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director for Alejandro Iñárritu. Birdman is kind of an existential comedy, with Keaton playing an actor named Regan Thompson, who's having a creative and personal identity crisis. Regan had been famous for starring as the superhero Birdman in 3 films, but he gave up the franchise years ago and has been struggling to figure out who he is as an actor and a man. He's dealing with the actor crisis by trying to prove his artistic worth, directing and starring on Broadway in his own adaptation of a Raymond Carver story. During rehearsals and previews, he's constantly second-guessing himself. His insecurities and doubts, as well as his self-absorption, are physically manifested in the form of Birdman, who keeps appearing to Regan, badgering him about having given up a lucrative Hollywood career for a play in an old Broadway theater. Birdman wants to regain the fame, glory, and power that comes with being a superhero. In this scene, Regan has just come off stage after one of several previews that turned into fiascos. He walks into his shabby dressing room, opens the little refrigerator, takes a slice of packaged cold cuts, and talks with his daughter Sam, who's working as his assistant. Sam is played by Emma Stone.
Dad. Dad.
Hey.
Are you okay?
Why?
You seem sort of...
No, I'm good. I'm good. This is good. You want some?
No.
Okay.
Do you really think you'll be ready for opening tomorrow?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, well, I mean, previews are pretty much a train wreck. We can't seem to get through a performance without a raging fire or a raging heart on. I'm broke. I'm not sleeping, like, you know, at all. And this play kind of starting to feel like a miniature, deformed version of myself that just keeps following me around and, like, hitting me in the balls with a tiny little hammer. I'm sorry, what was the question?
Never mind.
Michael Keaton, welcome to Fresh Air. I love Birdman and I love your performance in it. When I saw the movie, I thought, perfect. Michael Keaton has done 2 Batman films and was famous for that. He must really relate to this character who used to be a superhero and had been famous for that. And then I read or heard you say that you'd never played a character more unlike yourself before. So explain why, even though I thought you'd be resonating so much with the character, you kind of didn't, in spite of your great performance.
Well, you know, I probably should qualify that a little more than when I said it, which was a long time ago. I don't connect to that type of personality. I tend to not have those kind of personality traits, that constant neediness and insecurity and whininess and, you know, me, the narcissism. You know, when you're one of originally 9 children, you know, there's not a ton of room for that. And, you know, I was raised Catholic, so speaking about yourself or talking about yourself too much is not necessarily. And you know, then on the Protestant side of my family, even more so, do you not talk about yourself. So the whole thing of being self-involved took me a long, long time where I thought it was okay to talk about myself. But so it doesn't come to me naturally.
So how did Alejandro Iñárritu offer you the part? Did you ask your agent to go after it, or did he come after you knowing that you were the guy?
He came after me, and I don't think many people knew about the script because I think he was keeping it quite close to the vest. I got a call saying he wanted to meet me, and I was very familiar with his work. So I was going to find a way to make that meeting happen, and he handed me the script. Said, read this on the plane. And as I have said many times before, it would have to have been horrible, just like unreadable for me to say no. You know, I was pretty much in from the first phone call. Mm-hmm. But most of the conversation that evening was getting to know one another, and he really wanted to make clear what he was attempting to do here and how it was made, and also about the person. And as much as he talked about what the movie was about and how he wanted to make it clear what was going to be required of me, as much as we spoke about that, he spoke equally as much about himself. He's very forthcoming and open about his personal life and what he was going through and had been through, and how he thinks and feels about things and the changes he was going through, and turning 50 and confronting himself with really honest questions about his personal life and his artistic life. And that turned out was extremely helpful.
Birdman is in part about acting, about the egos, about all the talk about being truthful on stage. The actor that Edward Norton plays is like 100% authentic on stage, but as his girlfriend points out, he's a fraud in the real world where it counts. And with you, every time something awful or ridiculous happens to your character, like being locked out of the theater in your underwear, it seems to just bring out a deeper, more honest and more emotional performance in the play that your character is performing in within the movie. And you get more and more naked, metaphorically and literally, as the movie progresses. So the movie's kind of operating on two levels. It's kind of mocking actors, but also getting to what makes their work so beautiful and so deeply felt. What did you do to get to the truth of your character, who you've told us is in a lot of ways not like you?
Well, boy, that's about it. Just listening to what you just said is about as well put as I've heard it through all these interviews.
You.
That's about it. And it's true. And you know, listening to you describe it, it really resonates again with me, thinking about what Alejandro accomplished, and Chivo, Emmanuel Lubezki, the cinematographer and the camera operator and the crew and the cast and what everybody and the producers, what everyone really pulled off here in 29 days for very little money. And then I kind of retroactively become extremely frightened, thinking, what was I thinking? why did I ever think I should do this? And I think maybe really if I would have thought about it too much, it would have been overwhelming, because I actually end up playing kind of four different characters in the movie, which really didn't occur to me till we were about a week and a half or 2 weeks in, thank God. If you factor in that I play characters in the play and an actor who is actually directing other actors, and then I play those actors, and then I play the Birdman character, the actual Birdman, and my alter ego. And day to day and doing the work and getting to that honest point, that's, for me, it's always about, and it always will be as long as I do this, refining the truth. Just telling the truth, constantly being as truthful and honest and raw and real as you can be. And this was just the mecca of that. If I wanted to escape that, if I wanted to kind of be cowardly about it, I guess, and not expose myself to it and kind of maybe phone a little bit of it in, even if I wanted to, I couldn't have. I chose not to, because I think it was good timing at this point in my life and my career, and I'd like to think I'm a courageous actor anyway. I think that's the thing when it's all over. I hope someone at least says about me that I had a lot of guts, and, you know, sometimes you fail. But to go down, you know, to be frightened and to go down that hole and to be as raw as you can be, that's a blessing to me, to get that opportunity. You know, I could have failed miserably. People could have laughed at me and, you know, made fun of me for the rest of my life. And honestly, it probably would have hurt my feelings a lot. And then I would have gotten by it and said, well, you know what? Doesn't really matter, because I got a big set of balls. So.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Keaton. He stars in Birdman. He's nominated for an Oscar for Best Performance. The film is nominated for Best Picture. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Keaton. He's nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in Birdman, and the film is nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture. One of the really special things about the film is how it's shot and choreographed. There's a scene, and it's the scene that we opened the show with, in which you're taking some food out of the refrigerator after coming off after coming off a performance in which you'd locked yourself out of the theater and had to walk in your underwear around to the main entrance of the theater in order to get in, then walk down the aisle, do your performance on stage, finish the performance, and then go backstage and have that talk with your daughter. Is that all one take?
No, that
but,
is not all
not
one
take. I mean like one shot.
That's all one. Yes, I know what you mean. It's no, that is not all one shot,
okay.
But it's only two, like I would say like two and a half, really, because, and you know, you're right, actually, when I was listening to you explain to the audience how it was shot, even now I keep remembering things and I think about all the details because not only was it all those things you said going down the hallway, another actor has to enter precisely at a moment, then there might be three people in the hallway, then you go downstairs. It was even things like downstairs, out a doorway into the hallway where I see Edward, then we walk down a sidewalk. It had to be timed perfectly to get to a line exactly when I tossed the coins to the drummer and then timed out so we were dead on the exact word, not just the line, to enter the bar and then went into the bar and did the scene and then that whole scene runs through the bar, and then I go over and I walk back out. Well, the scene you're talking about, I think, was almost that long. So in all those shots, often it was also a cab had to pull up at the right time.
Right.
You know, and all the little details, and he is so detail-oriented. I mean, I can't imagine what it meant in his mind, in his brain, Alejandro's and Chivo's, but also, the actors had to be aware of it. I had to be aware of it. I had to know kind of what was going to happen at all time and at the same time stay right in the moment and stay locked in the character and be cognizant of all of every tiny detail that was happening in every tiny little bit of the frame. At the same time, forget it and just be in the moment and be truthful and just be the character, you know. Man, there's a lot to this movie.
Well, that sounds really hard.
Really hard.
But it's very exhilarating to watch. One thing I'm wondering is like if an actor, not you, but another actor made a mistake. After everybody works so hard to get all of the choreographed motions down with exact timing, with everybody's emotion being truthful and funny and in the moment. But one person made a mistake, so you have to do the whole thing over again. Would people get angry at that one person?
No, never. That's interesting. You would think that would at least happen at some point, but everyone was in the same boat, you know, and it didn't always exactly occur exactly like that. However, sometimes it would. You just go, oh, no, here we go.
Were you ever
you
that one person?
Really, I'm sure I was. I can't remember. You know, for me, it was never about, oh, I hope I make it to the end of the scene, because then you're not really in the scene. For me, it was about moment to moment, you know, second to second, scene to scene, just staying right on the truthfulness and staying in character and just being the person and just living the truth of it. And then we either got through it or we didn't. And when it didn't work, if you let that pull you down, you were, for me anyway, I was kind of done. I mean, you can't afford that. As mentally tired as I got through this movie, you couldn't afford to get angry or let down. Because then it all starts to fall apart. You know, it's like an athlete. You have to really emotionally and mentally bear down and be really just as tough and say, let's just keep going, let's just keep going, let's just keep going. And everybody, I think, had that mindset. So it never really got like that. It was more like, you know, who I really felt it for sometimes was someone who maybe had a small, small role in the movie. And they certainly don't want to be that person who walks in and is only working for 2 days and messes it up, because they probably feel a little bit like an outsider already. But there was just a big support system. Nobody ever really, you know. I mean, Alejandro, you know, would get very frustrated, but it was, you know, he knew it was brought on most of it by himself and Chivo, because they're perfectionists. And I tend to be perfectionistic too. So that's either a good combination or a bad combination. I don't really know.
So let me mention that scene again where you get locked out of the theater.
Yeah.
You leave your dressing room to have a smoke and accidentally got locked out, and you're in your underwear. It's raining out. So you have to walk around Times Square and get back into the theater through the main entrance where the ushers don't even recognize you and don't want to let you in. But anyways,
right.
while your character is walking around Times Square, he's recognized because he used to be, you know, the superhero Birdman. People are taking his picture and posting it on Twitter and YouTube. And so you really did walk across Times Square in your underwear to shoot that scene. Was it all extras who were watching you, or were there real people there too?
Real people, because you couldn't Once again, though, I'm sorry, just give me a second here. Every time I hear you describe things really well, I start to remember things again and or realize things that I'm not sure I realized at the time, because as you described all these things, I thought, you know, it was not just the scene, the entire movie, it was, for Regan Thompson, one indignity after another.
You know, and his fly is open half the time, too.
Yes, just horrible. Just yeah. Getting worse and worse and worse. Now, what's fortunate about all that is I happen to find that stuff really, really funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a weird job. The fact that I think that's a good idea to do that on a large screen and let millions of people watch it, and I think that's a good idea, that's really weird to choose that as an occupation. But I really do think that stuff is really, really funny.
Did you buy special underwear for the scene? It looks like just your regular...
Yeah, I wanted to go, and
what,
you know, and,
yeah.
And immediately
briefs,
as soon
briefs,
as
you, the briefs, not shorts.
Briefs, yeah. Yes, what they call briefs. And I knew I wanted to look, they're pathetic enough, but what really is the beautiful finishing touch is the black socks. That's what really sold me. Just so sad and pathetic. And him trying to hold his dignity up somehow, you know. Just for a second, here's how smart he and Chivo are. And as precise as this movie had to be, it also, you needed to be flexible. Like, there were things coming up that you went, oh, man, how, every day was problem solving. There are certain things you just can't know definitively how to shoot. So that always happened, and you had to rewrite or refigure or sit down or have a meeting. And one of them was, okay, we'll get extras for a while, and then they're probably going to disappear and get bored, and then they're not. How do you control the extras? Then how do you control the people from coming in? So kind of at the last second, he created that idea of the drummers and the marching band to distract people that way so that we could not get in the way of actually people, you know, messing up the shot.
When you're walking through the crowd, it's like you're power walking, like your arms are kind of pumping back and forth, almost as if like you're literally swimming through the crowd and you need your arms to propel you.
Yes. Here's a practical part of that. I'm a runner, you know, so in a jogger and a hiker and a walker, et cetera. So I still, my wind's pretty good. My legs are pretty strong and I can move. I can still go, you know, for a guy, you know, my age, but you can't really because camera can only go so fast. So you start to invent things. And one of the things I thought was just hold yourself upright kind of and do a strut that'll work for camera, but also look like kind of stupid, not stupid, but yeah. Kind of, you know, kind of like not silly because you can't go silly, but in a way, like kind of hold up his dignity. But in that shot, everyone talks about that stretch. For me, the front part of that, when I get caught in the door and how I was going to play that, play the reality of how do I get out of this jam? And when Regan walks away and try to like, goes into this crouch, like maybe if I crouch, no one will notice I'm in my underwear. And then the idea, maybe my favorite little spot in the movie is when he comes in at the theater and picks up the scene. And decides to continue playing the scene from the aisle in his underpants and a wig, in his black socks, and you know, the show must go on, and he keeps doing it. And that shot of Naomi when she looks out and sees me, and then she feeds me the line instead of saying, "Wait a minute, we have to stop. This is ridiculous." She just we all continue on with the play with a fake gun in my hand, you know, an imaginary gun. I mean, that stuff is really, really silly, and at the same time, just totally fits in with this movie. I mean,
time, your character is giving a great performance when he walks in spite of the underwear and the black socks and all of that.
Yes,
he's totally in the moment and totally authentic in that performance.
Yes, and also, you know, it's building toward the big moment where it took a breakdown for him to find for the play to come together and mm-hmm. him to come together in terms of a performance. It's just when you keep thinking about what he pulled off, and you know, if you'd have shot this traditionally, it would have been much, 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 much easier to do and not nearly as interesting.
Your character played a superhero called Birdman, and the Birdman character follows him around as his alter ego, and he's always just kind of insulting him and hectoring him and saying like, why did you know, you should have taken the role. You should have, like, played Birdman again. And you should have taken that reality show that you were offered instead of, like, doing this theater stuff. And so,
yeah.
So His alter ego is basically insulting him a good deal of the time. That's your voice, the voice of the Birdman alter ego, right? Mm,
right, right.
And are you also in the costume? Or is that somebody else?
No, that's me. And by the way, same dimensions as the original Batman suit. I'm very proud to say.
You haven't put on any weight.
Well, I did actually early on this movie. Alejandro would go to lunch with me and look at the plate, look at the waiter, look at me, and stand there and go keep pushing the plate, because you know the guy's down and out and been, you know, he's out of shape, et cetera, et cetera. So he really wanted that. But anyway, yes, it is me. And also, you know, Alejandro really and I worked on this early on, rehearsing, talking about it. Then we went into rehearsals, then we shot it, and then the post. In terms of getting the voice and getting the character and rewriting all that dialogue or monologue or language, you know, that Birdman comes up with and rewriting it and going back and trying different recording. Like, he wanted to do it really in a great studio, and then he didn't like the sound of it. It sounded too kind of perfect, so we found a place where the sound wasn't nearly as good, and we even had one where we could hear noise coming in from the window outside. And he's relentless and perfectionistic, and I was, you know, we had wrapped the movie, and he and I continued to work on it and work on it and work on it.
My guest Michael Keaton is nominated for an Oscar for Best Actor for his performance in Birdman. In the second half of the show, he'll talk more about his roles in Birdman and Batman, and about growing up with six siblings living for a while in an old farmhouse without plumbing or electricity. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. And from Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Keaton. He's nominated for an Oscar for his starring performance in the film Birdman, which is nominated for 8 other Oscars, including Best Picture. Keaton plays Regan Thompson, an actor who had been famous for starring in several blockbusters as the superhero Birdman. He gave up the franchise and is trying to reinvent himself on Broadway, directing and starring in his own adaptation of a Raymond Carver story. But he keeps seeing and hearing his Birdman character, who follows him around, hectoring Regan for having given up the franchise. Let's hear a moment of you as the Birdman, and this is his voice kind of like taunting you.
How did we end up here in this dump? You were a movie star, remember?
Okay, there he is, like, insulting you because you're doing theater instead of a superhero movie. So is that a processed version of your voice?
No. How that happened was when I did Batman, the first one, because I'm ridiculously logical, I and, you know, I got to have some reason for truth in the matter. Even if I am playing a guy in a big black rubber suit, I got to believe somewhere, you know, how I got to justify certain things. So, you know, we were doing a scene with Tim, and I said, hey, you know, we're downtown Gotham. I'm, you know, like 4.5 feet from one of the dignitaries in town. And I was looking at the lighting, and I said, this is not believable. You know, the guy's going to say, he's going to hear my voice, he's going to see my mouth and, you know, whatever he can see and go, hey, it's Bruce Wayne, everybody. You know, so I thought, I got to get around this. We got to, like, change my angle or we got to, and Tim thought it was a great idea, so we lit it kind of differently. And I said, I had already thought of creating a kind of like a very subtle change in his personality when he went from Bruce Wayne to Batman anyway. I kind of did it. A lot of it was cut out, but I did these other things. But just to justify it for me, I said, I got to make at least some voice change, something here that I can at least believe, you know. So I kind of did the shift in the voice at the top of the movie where I kick the guy into the door when he asked me who I am or what I am or whatever he asked me. And then I continued to use that voice when I was in the Batman thing, just, you know, as a thing. So I was telling the story to Alejandro, and he thought it was tremendous and funny, and he calls Chivo, Emmanuel Lubezki, over, goes, Chivo, listen to this. So we started laughing, and he said, oh, my God, you have to do that. That's it. That's what we're going to do. We're going to do a voice for Birdman. So I said, okay. And then the voice changed and changed and changed. It got a little more gravelly, and he got more. And he wanted me to go deeper with the voice and then raspy voice, then more dramatic. Then he'd hear it and would go back like a week later and change it again. And but that's really, that was the origin of it. And it became some kind of bastardized version of what the original Batman voice was.
So, you know, you're talking about the voice that you use as Birdman in the film Birdman and comparing that to the voice you used as Batman in your Batman film. So let's hear a short scene from the first Batman in 1989, directed, as you said, by Tim Burton. And this is from early in the movie, and two criminals are on a rooftop. They've just robbed a place. They're looking at their loot. And then you appear as Batman. You fight them off. You repel their bullets with your body armor. You use your Batman grappling hook. And then you dangle one of the muggers off the side of the building, and he's hollering for you to spare him.
Don't kill me. Don't kill me, man. Don't kill me. Don't kill me, man.
I'm not going to kill you. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
And as we can hear, Batman has a very stirring theme. And in Birdman,
yeah, I know.
And in Birdman, your character is always imagining that when he's fantasizing the powers that he had as Birdman and wanting those powers, he's fantasizing like his theme music behind him.
Yes, right, which is majestic and symphonic and really,
yeah,
like when he's flying. You mean, yeah, and beautiful actually. It's funny. I was just listening to that score, which is a great score. It's, great. And when you hear it, it's not that it sounds dated, because it's really good, actually. But you think, oh, I forgot it was that kind of score, you know, Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
And so, how about the courage when Alejandro said, I said, hey, you know, because I really liked his score in Babel, and I actually wanted to know what that instrument was. It sounded like a mandolin. It's actually not. I think it's a Middle Eastern stringed instrument. He told me what it was. That kind of is the base for that. And we were talking about that, and I said, how are you, what are you thinking about? You're going to use those guys again? And he said, no, I think I'm going to do drums, only drums. And I go, really? And he goes, yeah. And I'm thinking, yeah, good luck. He's never going to stick to that. This movie's going to need manipulation. It's going to need strings and, you know, blah, 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 because it's already risky what he's trying. Man, when I saw it, and he stuck to it and stuck with just the, I thought, wow. Man, this guy's got some guts. This is real, and it works. It works so great. It's crazy.
I agree. I completely agree. But getting back to Batman, how did it feel to be wearing the cape and the tights?
Simultaneously ridiculous to the point where you had to overcome it, and risky, And I guess kind of cool, I'm claustrophobic, so I had to work through that. It ended up working really perfectly for the character. It made me feel real isolated inside there. Couldn't really hear. And, so that really was ended up being a bonus, a plus for me. But once again, you think, oh boy, this is one of those things. This could really go down. This could just be a huge mistake. But if you punk out, or if you go halfway, or if you don't commit to it, or if you get frightened and kind of want to save yourself and not look, you know, that just doesn't work. That's just never going to work. So, not to me anyway. So you commit to it and say, okay, you know, I'm in. Let's make this thing work. And plus, I had the advantage also that the imagery is so strong and powerful. And once I saw that, I went, oh, this, I'm going to work this thing, man. I'm going to work the angles of the suit, the shadows of the suit, the frighteningness of it, the sexiness of it. I'm going to work the hell out of that.
So Tim Burton first cast you in Beetlejuice in 1988, and the story revolves around a couple played by Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin who are killed in a car accident, and they return to their home as ghosts, and a new family moves in, and Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis want these people out. So they go to another ghost played by you, Beetlejuice, who is a bio-exorcist, and it's his job to, like, scare these people out of the house. Let's play a scene. This is the first scene where you meet the couple played by Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis.
You know what's really beautiful about this? You two kids picked me. You didn't have to, but you picked me. It makes me want to kiss you guys. Come on. Come
no.
on. Give me one.
No.
Come on.
No.
Come on. All right, let's get down to business. You're right. I got a card around here somewhere. Here. Who do I have to kill? Here, hold that for me, would you?
There you
go.
You don't have to kill anybody.
Ah, possession.
Good.
Learn to throw your voice. Fool your friends. Fun at parties.
No, we just want to get some people out of our house.
Ah, I understand. Well, look, in order to do that, I'm really going to have to get to know you guys. You know, we got to get closer. Move in with you for a while. Get to be real pals. You know what I'm saying? And save that guy for later. Huh?
My wife and I would like to ask you a couple of questions.
Sure. Go ahead, shoot.
Well, for instance, what are your qualifications?
Ah, well, I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School. I travel quite extensively. I lived through the Black Plague, and I had a pretty good time during that. I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it. Not to mention the fact that you're talking to a dead guy. Now, what do you think? You think I'm qualified?
That's hysterical. You are so manic in that. And your voice reminds me a little bit of the voice we were talking about for Birdman.
Yeah, I guess.
Did it hurt to do that voice?
You know, I'm not in the movie that much, frankly. You know, listen to that, man, that brings back. I actually, you laid out the storyline of Beetlejuice, and I went, oh, that's right, that's what that's about. I forgot what the movie was about. and I realized how much of that was just written on the spot. I would just riff.
Oh, really?
And run.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, and that wasn't, the majority of that whole speech, in fact, was not really. You know, the whole, I attend Juilliard, and that was none of that was on the script, on the page. A lot of Beetlejuice was not on the page. The basics were kind of there, and I said, well, if I'm going to play him, I'm going to play him like this, and what do you think? And they were great. You know, Tim was tremendous about, you know, he was open to my interpretation.
My guest is Michael Keaton. He's nominated for an Oscar for his starring performance in Birdman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Wix.com, giving business owners the ability to create their own website with the drag-and-drop builder. Wix.com is used by 50 million people. Learn more at Wix.com. And from the American Psychological Association, participating in a national conversation about stress through the release of their Stress in America survey, designed to examine the impact of stress on health, relationships, and family. Learn more at stressinamerica.org.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Keaton. He's nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in Birdman, and Birdman is nominated for Best Picture. So did you grow up in a farmhouse in western Pennsylvania?
Yeah, actually it was an old farmhouse. The first house we grew up in we grew up really, we were kind of country people mostly, but, well, in Pittsburgh anyway, western Pennsylvania, there were mill towns or railroad towns, you know, and most of them were mill towns. My mom came from a mill town, a steel mill town down on the river. But in between was very rural. And then, you know, I wasn't that far from West Virginia, really, the border between Pennsylvania and West Virginia. And so when the very, very first house we were in, I'm looking at this studio. Honestly, I'm not exaggerating this. It was about, man, I don't know, three of these studios big with a little attic bedroom upstairs where my mother and father slept, and I slept in a crib in that room. And there must have been a period where my sister slept up there too, because there were, at that point, there was a period where there were nine people, but seven kids in a very small house. Very nice, neat, clean little house, but a small house. Then we moved right down the road because my father got the family farmhouse, which was totally run down. Totally run down. And I loved that house. It was huge and just fun and pockets and places to play and an old porch that barely was standing, you know, that you could jump off of into the, you know, there were no steps. It was just this old.
Electricity, plumbing, did you have that?
Well, we didn't. Yeah, we had electricity. And I never saw it as later, about a year ago, my sister told me, she said, you know, when we moved to that house, we didn't have plumbing. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, we didn't have it. We didn't have an indoor bathroom. She said, you know, it took a while for Dad to fix things up, and he had to do it himself, you know, kind of fix the pipes and hook it up and do everything. And then by the time, you know, he was always working two jobs, you know, his own surveying job, and he was kind of working on and off for the county. And then I didn't know that. And so I guess I was really still small. And then finally we got indoor plumbing. It sounds silly. It's not like we lived for years like that, you know. And then we moved down the road, and that house burnt down, actually, our old farmhouse, which was a sad day for me.
After you moved, it burned down?
Yeah, we had moved down, it just caught fire and just burned to the ground. And I'll never forget that night, we heard there was a fire. We all went up in our little pajamas and watched our old house burn down. It really made me feel sad. I loved that house. I think my mom and dad were glad to see it go. It was really hard to maintain. It was old, and, you know, my mom kept it really clean, and she did her best, but...
So your mother had seven children.
My mom had nine children.
She lost two of them?
And she lost two babies, yeah.
So you were the youngest of the seven kids who survived.
Yeah, yeah.
What did it mean to be the youngest?
It was kind of great. It was kind of great. Building an audience, you know. A lot of love, people. People kissing you and playing with you and beating you up all the time, you know, wrestling with you, and you always had to, like, you know, there was always wrestling. You had four guys in the family, so somebody's always, like, hitting somebody or chasing somebody or getting mad or fighting or wrestling or, you know, it was just, like, what you did. And so when you're the youngest, you know, it's good for you. You figure out real early how to get out of headlocks and holds really quickly, how to squirm your way out of your older brothers and sisters fighting. We're all really close, you know, we're all very, very close.
Was TV in your life from the very beginning? Did your family own a TV?
Yeah. That's how I knew. That's how I figured all this out, or fell in love with it. You know, books, reading, and stories that I would read, stories that I would make up. But television, you know, little television set. There was a period when I was really young where we had the only television I don't know if it was miles around, but my mother and father talk about neighbors coming down to watch something on the television, you know. And, you know, then people started getting television sets. We had a black and white TV, and I would watch old, you know, occasionally old movies would play on that, and then some television shows. I loved the Westerns, and I loved real Westerns. I loved gangster movies, you know, or army movies, you know. I was a ridiculously cliched kid, you know, anything that was male, boy, fighting, shooting, you know, all that stuff. I was just in love with it. I also loved gangster movies, Jimmy Cagney and John Garfield and all that stuff, you know. And then the comedies, I really got into the comedies.
So your parents were Catholic and observant.
My mom was. My dad was Protestant. And, you know, that was
a big
deal.
Oh, that's right. You're right. Right. So what did that make you?
It was a blessing because I distinctly remember, you know, hearing only Catholics are going to heaven. And I was blessed by it, because I really was a, you know, I bought the whole deal in Catholic school as a good Catholic kid. altar boy and all that. And I remember thinking, well, now, wait a minute. My dad's not Catholic. I haven't really seen him do anything really that wrong. You know what I'm going? This doesn't hold up logically to me. So I think somewhere in the back of my head, I tucked it away. I went, I'm kind of in. I'm mostly in on the religion thing, but not totally. That was a blessing in disguise, I think. You know, it really made me open-minded to things, I think.
Did you have an official exit point?
No, because I love being raised Catholic. I think it's very, I really like it. And I still, you know, if I meditate, I still occasionally find that because that's familiar territory. I'll find a church I think is cool, but not often. Or, you know, yeah, there were exit points kind of early on, you know, like in, you know, I was kind of a kid who got in trouble in high school and I was a party boy in college and I was a lot of fun. And also, you know, you start reading more and learning more and you're open to more people, you know, and different viewpoints and, you know, I'm a curious dude, so I read a lot. But I never was one of those guys who went, oh, my God, this is scarring. This is horrible. You know, I thought it was pretty cool. I liked it. And I love Pope Francis. I think he's pretty cool. I hope the other slipper doesn't fall, as they say. You know, we don't find out something weird down the road. I hope he gets in and out and everybody goes, wow, how about that dude? You know.
So your family name, the family that you're from, the family name is Douglas. But
yeah.
Because Michael Douglas was already Michael Douglas when you started acting professionally, you changed your name to Michael Keaton. Did you resent at all that somebody kind of owned your name already in the public
yes.
sphere?
Yes, I didn't think about it then, but I didn't resent it. I just thought, oh, that, okay, I actually like my name. You know, I've always kind of I thought, yeah, you know, it's my name. I'm pretty good with it. Yeah, and I use it actually occasionally. You know, I mean, I use it in private life all the time. It's my name. That's who I am. You know, but I just use the other one for jobs, which makes it really easy, clear. Frankly, makes things very simple. You know, this is how I make my career. This is how I make a living. This is how I live my life, and I sneak it in. You know, I direct a little movie, and I want to use it. I like my name. I want to tuck it in there somewhere. I'm trying not to go through the whole John Cougar Mellencamp thing, which went on for years. You know?
So you changed it to Keaton in honor of Buster
Keaton?
Yeah, no,
just randomly.
Just randomly?
Trust me, I'll talk about it if you want to talk about it. It's so dull, I can't tell you. I mean, really, I've been through this literally thousands of times, or at least hundreds of times. But if you want to hear it, I'll tell you. But honestly, you'll nap. If you haven't had a nap, now would be a good time. There's a union. You can't get in if somebody's got a name. I got a gig. I didn't make up a name. I was in the K's. I said, this seems kind of down the middle of the road, kind of flows nicely, and I'll figure out a cool name, you know, in a few weeks when I get the next job. And they said, you got to sign this thing now. You're going to start work tomorrow. Made it up. Never changed it. And that's it.
All right.
Good
oh,
for
I'm
you.
Sorry.
Wise choice.
My guest is Michael Keaton. He's nominated for an Oscar for his starring performance in Birdman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Keaton. He's nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in Birdman. The film is nominated for Best Picture. Can I play you just like one little clip from Birdman? I want to know who this voice is because it sounds so familiar and I can't place it. It's a great voice. There's a scene in Birdman, and this isn't a spoiler because it's in the trailer, when you're on the roof and you're kind of feeling your Birdman's superpower, but you're also in a very vulnerable state. And people are looking at you yeah. on the roof and not knowing, is this guy a jumper or is this a movie? Like, what is going on? So here's a yeah. woman who's yelling up yeah. at you.
people are full of crap.
I love that. Who is that
makes
voice?
Me laughing. That's her. As far as I know, that's that actress. You see, the thing about this movie is you look at even that, you barely see that woman, and she just nailed that. Every little role was performed really well by really good actors in this movie. I really love that scene. That makes me laugh a lot when she says that. That's that actress.
Like what actress? You know, like you don't know
I
her
can't
name.
Remember a woman's right, name, okay, no. Because okay. I actually never met her, actually, because
that was just added in?
No, she performed and she was right on cue. I mean, I kept thinking, oh man, you know, I'm standing on the edge of this building, you know, and this is nervous making. I'm not crazy about heights, and 9 stories up, and I'm thinking, man, I hope everybody's on their cue, and they were, and she was right on it, because it had to happen at the precise moment when the camera comes up the side of the building and it's like inches from my face, and then swirls around the back and has to pick her up, and so she had to be cued precisely. That's just something that people don't get. They don't realize how hard all that stuff is to do, you know. And it's not like you have a $80 million or $120 million in days to in different crews, you know, like 4 crews where this was handmade, and you know, we had to pull all that stuff off.
So when you're on the edge of that roof 9 stories high and you have
knees shaking
and you have fear of heights, do you have any protection?
Yeah, you know, you're cabled in and the guys were great and all that.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, to be honest with you, you go, yeah, you know, I'd probably feel better if the movie were, you know, like $90 million and I'm cabled in than you know, a few million dollars. Because you go, who'd they get exactly to secure me to this building? You know, this is a guy who works like once every 9 years and goes, yeah, I got a garage, but I'll, you know, down the road, but I got some cables. I'll do it for you. You know, that was my fear more than the, and standing on the edge of 9 stories is not pleasant. And also you need to, you know, I thought more than anything, I really want to be locked into the guy here. He's really fragile. And once again, it worked, you know, the fear, I think I just thought, and I picked a spot deep far in the horizon to focus on to set. So I wouldn't, I didn't want to teeter and go in and out of focus when the camera came up, so it would get the shot. But also, you know, I remember lines had to be on cue and be convincing, but then say, but you know, what's my state right now? So I focused across the way, never realizing as the camera come up inches from my face, your depth of field changes and you get disoriented. And the remarkable job of the focus puller. I mean, just this guy just nailed it. Some of those things could be 20 takes, and we nailed it the first time, really, and then we just did 2 more just to have it.
Well, what you're describing is perfect, because your character at that point is kind of wobbling between this superhero yeah. image that he still has and being at the most vulnerable point of his life.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And just, that's right. He's really now entering that really, really dark. He's gone. He's kind of, I think this is the beginning of him being liberated. You know, this is the beginning.
Yes.
Where he just says, you know, hell with it, man.
You use the word liberated, and mm-hmm. Everyone I know who's seen the movie has the discussion about what does the ending mean. Do you want to say anything about what it means to you, or would you prefer not?
I can only say what I can say what Alejandro says, which I really agree with, which is it has as many interpretations as there are seats in the theater, as there are people in seats in the theater, which some people get, most people really like it. I mean, like, not knowing, like the ambiguity or knowing that they've got their own take on it, or like the discussion. Some people seem a little frustrated by it, but I would wonder why one would be frustrated by it. But for me, I don't know. I don't think about it much, actually. I kind of have in the back of my head what I like. But what's kind of cool is I just thought, I don't really care one way or another. And I think, I don't know, how do I know it won't change in 10 days? Or how do I know I'll look at it again and go, oh, you know what I think? Or you know what I want to feel here? You know what I choose to think? Mm-hmm. Or choose not knowing, kind of, you know. I think the not knowing is the best option.
Well, Michael Keaton, thank you so much for this interview, and thank you for your performance in Birdman.
Thank you for having me. It's great.
I really enjoyed it. So good
me
luck.
Too, thanks.
Good luck at the Oscars.
Yeah, well, it means a lot to me. I'm really excited.
Michael Keaton is nominated for an Oscar for his starring performance in the film Birdman, which is nominated for 8 other Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, our guest will be David Axelrod, who's been called everything from President Obama's message maven to a lefty lumberjack. He'll tell us about shaping media strategy for two presidential campaigns and share some moments from his years at the Obama White House, including one when the president called him an unrepeatable expletive. Axelrod has a new memoir called Believer. If you haven't tried listening to our podcast yet, this would be a great time. We've made some improvements that we're very happy about. You can subscribe through iTunes or your mobile app. It's easy, it's free, and it's available to listen to whenever you want to hear it. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Grove.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from PBS with The Forgotten Plague from American Experience, a look at tuberculosis, one of the deadliest killers in human history and its impact on American society. The Forgotten Plague, tomorrow at 9, 8 Central on PBS. And from Angie's List, offering an updated app for iPhone and iPad that lets members compare consumer reviews, shop local service offers, and schedule projects with the Snap Fix feature. More at AngiesList.com.
David Axelrod has been called everything from President Obama's message maven to a lefty lumberjack. On the next Fresh Air, he tells us about shaping media strategy for two presidential campaigns and shares some moments from his years at the Obama White House, including one when the president called him an unrepeatable expletive. Axelrod has a new memoir. Join us.